Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
If we walk away from this, we're basically telling the world that not addressing sexual assault with the respect and seriousness it requires is okay.
The Women's Tennis Association pulls out of China in support of champion player Peng Shuai. I asked WTA Chairman Steve Simon what this means for women's rights and for his bottom line then. As nuclear talks resume, Iran demands sanctions be removed, while UN inspectors report ramped up uranium production there. I speak to Mohammad Marandi, a member of the Iranian delegation, and to journalist Ronan Bergman about secret cyber skirmishes between Israel and Iran. Also, playwright Tony Kushner on honoring Stephen Sondheim's legacy in his blockbuster reimagining of West Side Story. Plus,
is the pandemic over? Was it real?
Hari Srinivasan talks to Palestinian-American comic Mo Amma. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. When the Women's Tennis Association announced its decision to suspend all tournaments in China, league chairman Steve Simon took a crucial stand in defense of its champion Chinese player Peng Shuai and in support of women's rights, saying, if powerful people can suppress the voices of women and sweep allegations of sexual assault under the rug, then the basis on which the WTA was founded, equality for women, would suffer an immense setback. WTA co-founder Billie Jean King tweeted her support for the decision. I applaud Steve Simon and the WTA leadership for taking a strong stand on defending human rights in China and around the world. The WTA is on the right side of history in supporting our players. And men's champion Novak Djokovic called it a very bold, courageous stance. The Chinese Tennis Association, for its part, is opposed, saying that it would damage the interest of the entire sport of tennis. So why has the WTA thrown down this gauntlet at this time? And at what cost? CEO Steve Simon is joining me now from Los Angeles. And welcome to the program, Mr. Simon. You've taken a bold step, and from what I can gather, it's the first time a major organization has thrown down this kind of gauntlet to the Chinese in response to human rights and other violations. But it's going to cost you a huge amount, right? Can you tell me the amount of money and contracts involved and whether that at all was a consideration?
Well, thanks for having me. And I think to address your question straight on, what it will cost us by taking this stance is still very much uncertain. We do believe it will be significant if, in fact, we're forced to suspend all of our events and we're not actually able to operate due to the local Chinese authorities not wanting to take these accusations and allegations seriously. It's a complicated pathway that we've embarked upon, but we are resolute in our position on this, and we're willing to deal with the challenges that will come forth as a result.
So you have about 10 tournaments, and as you say, they're suspended for the moment. You haven't canceled them formally, but you've sent a direct message, and that is, as you know, in direct collision with China, the government, the spokespeople, the Chinese Tennis Association, who they say it'll just damage, you know, the entire sport. What do you say to them? I mean, their reaction is to be expected, but very few people take them on, certainly not in the sports world. What do you say to the Chinese government's reaction?
Well, I would say that at this point, it's unfortunate. It's not going to affect the overall sport of tennis. The sport of tennis is a global sport. It's one of the largest consumed sports in the world today. And it's going to continue to grow. We as the WTA in China have had a great experience over there to date. We have great friends. We have great partners in the region. And this is very unfortunate. This is a situation where we're dealing with right and wrong. And there's too many times in this world in which we're faced with challenges such as this, where we allow politics and government and money and financials to get into the way of of what the right decision is, and we end up with compromised decisions. When we're getting into the issue of sexual assault, it is at the core principles as to what you reflected in your opening as to what the WTA stands for, and with what Billie Jean in the original line, you know, developed this organization and organized it around. It is about, you know, the principles of respect, opportunity, and equality. When you get to sexual assault, it cannot be compromised in any way, shape, or form. And in this situation, you have to separate the business side from the point of what's right and wrong, and we're going to side on the side of what's right and wrong.
So many women around the world in any sector, not just sports, not just tennis, will applaud that. And my question to you, though, is you actually want the Chinese government to do something, that is to actually present Peng Shuai in a way that you all can see she's neither coerced nor dictated to, nor in any other way, you know, have her own free will impinged on. But you also want an investigation. You've received emails from Peng Shuai in, you know, since you've taken your stance. Do you have any reason to believe those emails really come for her, were dictated to her? How would you characterize them?
Well, I would characterize them as orchestrated at this point in time. When you come out with the allegations that Peng did early in November, they were significant and they were detailed. And now to be receiving the emails and the correspondence from her that certainly are very, they're just 100% orchestrated, and I do not think that they reflect what the allegations did and the true position. I can only imagine the range of emotion feelings that she's going through.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any other independent way of knowing from your contacts there whether she's under duress or whether she's just, you know, having to do what she's told right now, or whether there's an even darker aspect to what she might be, you know, undergoing right now?
Sure. We don't have a lot of contact coming out of the region. The contact that we've had from the region has basically been consistent. She's in Beijing. She's fine. She's not under no physical stress, etc., which is what we've seen in the videos and the pictures that we've seen. We just feel very strongly that this is certainly being orchestrated. It's consistent with those that are very familiar with the region as to how these things are handled over there. It is fully expected, and as you reflected before, we have two principal points right now, which is we definitely want to confirm that Peng is available to speak without censorship or any pressures or any restrictions in any way. And we do want a full and transparent investigation as of these very serious allegations.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Sun, can I just ask you how you know, we've had the IOC senior official Dick Pound on this program. The IOC are the only ones who've actually spoken to her and have released a picture. I try to press them to release the entire audio of their conversation with her in that video conference. That hasn't happened. But they don't believe that you are on the right track, that, as they said, beating your chest in public is not the way to get anything out of the Chinese. Let me play. This is before your announcement of the suspension.
Sure.
Let me play what Dick Pound told me on this program a few days ago.
The ATP may have its own views, but I don't think they've been paying much attention to what's happened in basketball and football in threatening the Chinese with economic sanctions on this. It's not going to work. And part of the proof of the pudding is they were not able to get in touch with her. And that, you know, that's her sport. And maybe she didn't like the attitude that they were showing.
So he said ATP, he obviously meant the WTA. But it's this classic dilemma, right? Some believe that you can get more by quiet diplomacy. Obviously, the IOC believes that. And they have the Winter Olympics in question. And you, on the other hand, believe in laying down this very clear ethical marker for the Me Too allegation and her safety. How do you think this is going to proceed? Have you talked to the IOC? Do you think it's going to become a sort of a bit of a battle? Will the Chinese be able to divide and conquer, for instance?
Well, it's a very good point that you raise. And clearly, with the IOC videos that were shared, and you can follow Mr. Pound's comments, obviously, they have been able to convince either the government or Peng to have that discussion. I think when you watch that, I believe that you can also see that it's very much orchestrated. Peng has known where to reach out to us, and it's been chosen that they deal with the IOC. Obviously, we've taken a very firm stand, and we've taken it for a reason. It is the time, as I said earlier, that we need to be addressing what's right and wrong. And we cannot be in a position where we're telling the world that the addressing of sexual assault is not being addressed with the respect and seriousness it requires, because it's difficult. It's just something that we cannot let happen. And I think we've been very, very clear from the get-go that anything less than that is unacceptable.
Now, the ATP has today, their chairman, have said that they are also monitoring the Peng Shuai situation, that they are also calling for this investigation to be concluded or undertaken even. But they're in some bit of hot water as well, the ATP, because this is about their champion player, Alexander Zverev. Now they have said that they are going to be announcing an internal investigation. But he has been accused of domestic violence by a former girlfriend. Of course, he himself strongly denies the allegation. He says he welcomes any investigation. But do you think, given the moral stance that you've taken in this case, do you think the ATP should take an equally moral stance on, you know, on Zverev pending the results of the investigation? Would you think that he should be suspended if an allegation of such was made against a member of the WTA? Would you consider they should be suspended pending an investigation?
I think you have to be consistent, and as you've reflected there, that anytime these accusations occur and people have the courage to come forth with them, they deserve a full and transparent investigation without any levels of censorship. And based upon the findings of those investigations, the appropriate results should come from that. And should they go through the process and should it prove that Mr. Zverev was guilty, then he should be punished accordingly. In fairness, if it comes out that the investigation reflects that they were untrue, then of course that has to be addressed in the same way. But every time this happens, there should be an appropriate investigation to find out the results, and people should be accountable based upon the results of those investigations.
Just very quickly, a suspension pending an investigation is not something you would agree to then?
I think that they need to go through the investigation first, yes. That would be my opinion, but that's part of the ATP. Okay. It's not under my jurisdiction.
Mr. Simon, thank you so much indeed. This case will continue and we'll keep watching it. Now, another round of Iran nuclear talks is underway in Vienna, with a new, more hardline regime calling the shots this time from Tehran. The U.S. Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, says there's not a lot of cause for optimism, but that it's still not too late. Iran demands an end to draconian sanctions imposed by the United States, this after the Trump administration pulled out of the agreement. Meanwhile, the UN nuclear watchdog reports that Iran started producing enriched uranium with more efficient and advanced centrifuges at its underground nuclear plant at Fordow. Mohammed Marandi is an advisor to Iran's negotiating team, and he's joining me now from Vienna. Welcome to the program. We've talked to you a lot in the past about these issues. So The U.S. Secretary of State is saying, not a huge cause for optimism of getting this deal back on track, particularly in the wake of the IAEA's latest report of the increased uranium enrichment and the more advanced centrifuges, and including, he says, a lack of access to a particular facility in the region of Karaj. Do you share that lack of optimism?
If there is a lack of optimism, it is because of the actions of the United States. The current administration in Washington was, the president of the United States, was critical of Trump's maximum pressure campaign. Yet when he came to power, he continued with that policy and continues with that policy today. The United States is in clear violation of the agreement and in violation of a UN Security Council resolution, whereas the Iranians were fully implementing the nuclear deal. Even after the United States left the deal, the Iranians continued to abide by the deal in full for a full year, even though the Europeans effectively left the deal. Then after a year, the Iranians gradually decreased their commitments and then stopped their commitments. And even that was in accordance with the deal, because Articles 26 and 36 allow Iran to stop implementing the deal when the other side is not abiding by their side of the bargain. So the only side that from the very beginning was sitting at the table and stayed at the table is Iran. The United States left the table, caused hundreds of billions of dollars of damage to the Iranian economy. And I think it's rather strange for the United States to be demanding of Iran at this stage.
Right. So, but let me just put it to you, because you also know that the JCPOA says that Fordow should not be used. I hear what you said about the reciprocal non-compliance, but Fordow is a step beyond, and also the IAEA needs full satisfactory access. As the chief said to me, without our, you know, signing off on what's happening at the plants and the various places in Iran, there is no negotiation and there's no deal possible. Is Iran just using this as a negotiating tactic, or does this particular government negotiating team maybe not so eager to get into the deal again?
The current administration sent a heavyweight delegation to Vienna. There were three deputy foreign ministers here and a series of high-ranking officials. So obviously, Iran is very serious. With regards to the installation in Karaj, a sabotage was carried out, which caused damage to the facility. And the Iranians believe that the United States and Israelis were behind it. And with regards to Fordow, it is a right of Iran within the framework of the IAEA and the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The only reason why Iran was no longer using it for enrichment was because of the nuclear deal. If the Americans don't want Iran to use it, then they should have thought about that earlier. They should have remained within the deal. But the American government can't have its cake and eat it too. They can't expect to violate the deal to impose suffering on ordinary people intentionally, and then expect the Iranians to sit back and abide by their commitments within the framework of the deal. That's a very strange expectation that the Americans and the Europeans have.
I want to pick up on your last point, which is that there was sabotage at the Karaj plant, and the Iranian government believes that it's the handiwork of the United States and Israel. I'll be talking right after this interview to the Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman, who's broken a lot of news stories about these cyber attacks and the sort of cyber war that's going on. There's been, and it's been reported, and obviously you experienced it in Iran recently, an attack on gas stations, petrol stations, that was caused a huge amount of problem for civilians. And at the same time, what the Israelis believe to be potentially an Iranian cyber attack on a dating site in Israel that caused a huge amount of sensitive information to be released into the public on a huge number of people. What is the state of this cyber war as it moves from government installations to the civilian population? How do you think that's going to affect people in Iran?
The real problem is that the United States has created a culture where it can attack countries with impunity. It can destroy Libya. It can destroy so much of Syria, carry out a dirty war there. It can help the Saudis destroy Yemen. It can invade Iraq, occupy Afghanistan. It can do whatever it wants. It can impose illegal sanctions on a country. And the Israelis do the same thing. They constantly bomb Syria. These are all violations of international law. So now the United States, the Israelis, they carry out cyber attacks against Iran, and no one in the West complains because apparently it is okay for them to do it. If it was Iran that carried out such an attack on the United States or Russia or China, what would have been the response in Washington? So the real problem is that the United States has gone rogue, and its ally, the Israeli regime, a regime that we consider to be an apartheid regime, has gone rogue as well. If the United States wants to bring back stability to this region, at a time when the United States has so many internal problems, economic problems, it is dealing with rising powers like China and Russia. If it wants to cut costs and to ease tensions in this region, the only way forward, the best way forward, is to end the hostility, the attacks, the assassinations, the sabotage, the cyber attacks, and to accept the nuclear deal and to end the Trump maximum pressure sanctions.
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out, whether there is a realistic hope of that happening. I'm going to put these questions now to our friend in Israel, Ronan Bergman. But Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, says the U.S. should call off the talks altogether after the IAE report. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports a new cyber conflict, as we've just been discussing, breaking out between Israel and Iran, which is targeting each other's civilians now. And journalist Ronan Bergman co-wrote that, and he's joining me now from Tel Aviv. Ronan, welcome back to the program. You heard what Mohammed Marandi has just told us. Tell us a little bit more. They are clear, and they really believe that it was Israel and the United States, as they say, who sabotaged the Karaj nuclear plant. What do you know about that particular one? You've done so much reporting on all of this.
Well, there was a series of sabotage and bombings. And some of them, at least according to U.S. sources, were done by Israeli intelligence, not necessarily with the help of the U.S., but many with the pre-knowledge. And during the Trump time, the Trump administration, with the U.S. consent, if not enthusiasm, to support this campaign of sabotage. In addition, the U.S. has killed, by some reports, with the help of Israeli intelligence, Iran's number one operation executive, Qasem Soleimani, and Israel has killed the chief nuclear scientist, Fakhrizadeh, just a year ago in a sabotaged ambush done by a robot commanded from afar. This is an, I would say, not a shadow war anymore. It's an open war between those two countries, Israel and Iran, that pops up in different areas in the Middle East. The previous interview, you have said, talking about Syria and Iraq. You have mentioned the cyber war. I think that there's no sphere, land, sea, air, cyber, where those nations are not in all-out war, fighting each other on different kind of hegemony, control, Israeli fear of Iran making its way to a nuclear bomb. And Iranian claims that Israel aligning with the U.S. in order to diminish Iran's influence in the area.
Mm-hmm. So you've broken a lot of these stories, and now the latest is this movement of the cyber war from government and official and infrastructure installations to just civilians. The Israeli attack on the Iranian sort of gas station infrastructure, and the Iranian counterattack on this Israeli dating app, which apparently exposed the information of potentially 16% of Israel's population, and particularly sensitive information. It was an LGBTQ site, very, very sensitive information. What is the point of this, Ronan Bergman, and does this lead to a military confrontation? What has caused it to move from infrastructure to civilian targets?
So the story you are referring to, Christian, I wrote with my friend, colleague, and great journalist, Farnas Fasikh, the New York Times, describe, I would say, the proliferation of cyber war, which is not new. Those two sides exchange cyber blows for the last more than a decade. Israel and the U.S. has initiated an Olympic Game operation to sabotage and destroy much of the centrifuges installed in the same place where the explosion that was mentioned previously in Natanz and Karaj just happened. But what happened in the last 2 years was that, according to Israel, Iran has started to attack Israeli water pipe infrastructure, in some cases being able to get control over some of those pipes, and according to Israeli intelligence, trying to mix poison into the water, trying to hurt people. And Israel, in its turn, according to U.S. officials, was severely damaged, the flow of oil, flow of gas from the central stations to the gas stations, causing unbelievable eruption and disturbance to daily life, either not enabling people to refuel their cars or forcing them to pay in cash and not use the subsidiary card, something that cost them twice or third as much. This is, for the first time, harming vast population, and in return, Iranian hackers hacked the server storing the data for the biggest LGBT site of Israel, which is not just the names of those people, many of them are not out of the closet, but also many intimate details about their sexual preferences, who is HIV plus, pictures. And you can imagine the immense, you mentioned 1.5 million people registered to that website, understanding their the most intimate details are out there, posted on the Telegram channel of the Iranian hacking group, and the amount of panic and hysteria in Israel. And I would say, for the first time, what we are seeing is not just countries fighting, but massive population suffering from that.
But Ronan, where do you see it heading? And of course, I'd said 16% of the population. What I meant was the population signed up to this dating site. But what is the point? Where do you see it going? Some are worried that this, you know, civilian aspect of it could at some point tip back into a military confrontation or into a military confrontation.
Well, I think that there are two things here. One is that the purpose, according to intelligence experts who are updated with the details of that attack, the purpose of the attack on the gas fuel system, those 4,000 gas stations, was to create some civil unrest and bitterness toward the regime that is not able to supply gas. In time when we know this has happened exactly 2 years after the riots that erupted when subsidy on oil was cut down. So this is a very sensitive point, and whoever was behind the attack understood that and wanted to cause civil unrest. I think what the Iranians are doing to counter that was to attack soft points in the Israeli infrastructure. Would that lead to military confrontation? The military confrontation is already there. Israel is attacking Iranian targets, military build-up targets in Syria almost every day. But there's something more frightening, and it goes back to your conversation with the advisor to the Iranian delegation to the talks in Vienna. If Iran reaches or crosses a red line that it is very close to, for example, enriching uranium to 90%, military grade, Israel will probably say there is no reason for peaceful research or production of energy, nuclear energy, to enrich to 90%. That means the Israelis would claim only one purpose, to serve as a core for a nuclear bomb. This is right. A red line that Israel have demonstrated numerous times in the past. It will not allow anyone right. to pass. And I don't think that the region is going into a very good place now.
Right, indeed. I mean, the United States says right now they don't see 90% enrichment. It's very, very important to say that. It's much lower at this point, but clearly this is a flashpoint to be watched. Ronan Bergman, thank you so much. Next to two different warring gangs who've been fighting, singing, and dancing for more than 60 years. I'm talking about the Sharks and the Jets from the iconic musical West Side Story, originally landing on Broadway in 1957. Now, this take on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet is hitting the big screen again, courtesy of Steven Spielberg. Here's their version of Tonight.
Tonight, tonight, it all began tonight. I saw you on the whirlwind away. Tonight, tonight, there's only you tonight. What you are, what you do, what you say.
And we're joined now by the film's screenwriter, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, Tony Kushner. Welcome back to the program. You must be thrilled. Early reviews are really great. I think it was in 2014 that Spielberg first approached you about this. What did you think? I mean, did you know, there was already an iconic film that has, you know, held everybody's imagination for that long.
Yeah, I mean, the 1961 film is without question one of the most beloved films in cinema history, and certainly one of the great movie musicals. It's also the source of some controversy, but it's unquestionably a great bit of filmmaking, and Stephen and I both love the film, the 61 film, very much. So when he first asked me if I'd be interested in doing this, I thought he was crazy, and it took a little while for me to change my mind, but eventually I got very excited about it, and I had a fantastic time working on it.
Well, everybody's looking forward to seeing it. But I want to ask you, obviously, about Stephen Sondheim, because this doesn't come just from the film. It comes from Stephen Sondheim's great lyrics and music. And, of course, he died just after Thanksgiving, suddenly at the age of 91. Just talk to me a little bit about him, what kind of collaboration you may have had with him over the years, and did you discuss this film version with him before he died?
I think I met Steve in the early 1990s, and probably around 2000. We became friends. We weren't close friends, but we were in contact on and off. I interviewed him on stage a number of times, and I revered him. I mean, I think, you know, one of the greatest songwriters that ever lived, one of the greatest practitioners of the musical theater form, maybe the greatest ever, a real genius, which is a word that I don't use lightly. His lyrics are astonishing. His music is magnificent. West Side Story was the first professional production he was involved with. In 1957, he was 24 years old when Arthur Lawrence approached Leonard Bernstein and said, "I know this guy who's a talented songwriter. Why don't we hire him to be the lyricist?" And to Bernstein's eternal credit, he said yes. And the lyrics in West Side Story are absolutely astonishing. And I've spent 7 years with them now, and they never fail to offer up new surprises. He was a writer of incredible depth and understanding of human nature, and he really understood how a song in a musical has to function in terms of advancing the narrative arc and deepening the audience's understanding of character and conflict. There's really nobody better than Sondheim at that. He really moved the whole form forward. Our debt to him, who loved musicals, is incalculable. So
he did, as you say, revolutionize the idea of the musical. And yeah, his legacy will continue for a long time. But I want to pick up on what you said about the previous much-loved film with Natalie Wood, Rita Moreno. Natalie Wood famously was, you know, browned up for her role. It's a kind of, you use the word controversy about some of the aspects of the first film. You know, Tell me what you've done to bring it out of that sort of controversy and into the real world of today. And, you know, were you always sure that you wanted to do this, given the controversies that did exist around it?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned that there are controversies around West Side Story. I mean, specifically from the Puerto Rican community and from the Latinx community, there are feelings that the representation, both in the source material itself, in the 1957 musical, and in the Robert Wise-Jerome Robbins film, there are problems. And there are unquestionably problems. It's a product of its time, the original musical and the 61 film. There were things that were done that would not be done now, including having a white actress of European descent, like Natalie Wood, play a Puerto Rican girl, a teenage girl, with brown face on. And many other decisions that were made that were absolutely problematic, and I can understand have caused people serious pain. And I take that seriously now. And Stephen and I took it very seriously when we attacked the business of making our own version of West Side Story, which is much more based on the 1957 musical in many ways than on the 61 film. I feel like what we really did, it's hard to describe it. There are so many things that were done to try and make the representations of all the characters recognizable to people who have lives that are similar to the lives or come from the same culture or ethnic heritage as the characters on screen. But in a way, I felt all along that I was just taking the four gay Jewish men who wrote West Side Story and created it, Jerome Robbins and Arthur Lawrence and Stephen Sondheim and Leonard Bernstein, at their word. They were very, they absolutely wanted to make a musical that was about racism and the horrendous consequences of racism. There were things that they did where they sort of missed the mark. There are many things where they didn't miss the mark. The characters that they created, I think, are very vivid. I don't think that they're stereotyped. With great respect, I can understand why there's a certain animus towards West Side Story. But I obviously, Stephen and I didn't share that animus, or we would never have made the movie in the first place. And I really hope that people come to see our film. I promise you, within the first 5 or 10 minutes, if you have doubts about the politics of West Side Story, you'll see things that you mm-hmm. haven't seen in any version of West Side Story that will, I don't want to give anything away, but that will maybe, if you're open-minded, make you think otherwise. We never did it because we wanted to, sorry.
No. I'm just saying we're looking forward to seeing it. And, I wish we could talk a lot more about this, but certainly Stephen Sondheim was very, very complimentary of your work on this. He said that to, the Late Night Show the other day or before he died. So we're all looking forward to this. Tony Kushner, thank you so much indeed. From a legend of the theater to a rising comedic star, a pioneer in Arab-American stand-up, Mo Amma is returning to our screens for his second Netflix comedy special, Mohammed in Texas. And here he is discussing the power of comedy with Hari Srinivasan.
Christian, thanks. Mo Amma, welcome. And I got to ask, is this part of like a sponsorship deal that you're in the back of a Bentley or something? Why are you in this car when you're having this conversation with us?
It's a Mercedes, okay? Put some respect on Mercedes, okay? If I want anything, I want something from Mercedes, to be honest with you. it's a unique situation. I'm currently filming my series for Netflix. It's loosely based on my life. And we're currently outside of my middle school doing the flashback sequences.
This is in addition to your stand-up special that's also your second stand-up special that also dropped on Netflix. I mean, you're a guy who goes out on the road and talks to people and feels the crowd. So how do you find the material that you think kind of plays to all kinds of different audiences?
Right. I mean, it's important. Again, it comes back to just like understanding human beings and just really being in touch with people on the ground. You know, I don't really need the internet. I travel so much and I speak to so many different people from all different walks of life. And I think that's the recipe, is always being in touch with your roots, with the people that I grew up with, and then just really expanding your mind and meeting people from various backgrounds. And that's what really did it for me, you know, always. And my mentor, Danny Martinez, told me very early on to be universal. And that doesn't mean you're not thought provoking. It doesn't mean you don't hit on really difficult topics, but just really taking the time out to make it digestible for everyone. And that's always the goal.
You know, in this stand-up, you kind of come back to this feeling and you express it kind of like as a grunt. I'm, you know, tell us, because that's kind of something that people connect with when they're like, yeah, I kind of feel exactly like what he just sounded like.
Is the pandemic over? Was it real? But what, is it over? No, for real, I'm asking, is it though? And I'm always like laughing and about to cry at any moment in time. I'm like, was it real? Is it?
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. That's, yeah, it's again, trying to capture where everybody feels inside, including myself. You know, I got divorced in the middle of the pandemic. I had a TV show that I was developing and trying to put everything together there. And it was so, so hard to do. So it was just something I kind of stumbled into, because when I came into the first show after 3.5 months of the pandemic, I was just 100 miles an hour. I was neurotic. I was anxious. I was afraid to be around people. I mean, they got me, you know, like they completely got in my head and I was all over the place. And then for a moment, after the rambling, I just went like that. And the entire audience just died laughing. I was like, oh, this is what everybody's feeling. And then I just leaned into it and just, I just thought it'd be really funny throughout the set. Any moment that I would get feel like any kind of ease, remember, like 2020 can hear you, relax, you know, one of those things. So that was part of it. And what's not in the special, I remember some guy said, how much worse can it get? And I was just like, shut up, man. It can get worse. Just be thankful that it's just this. And sure enough, it just kept getting worse.
I want to play a clip of you talking a little bit about the stock market and what's been happening and kind of this distraction era that we live in. Let's take a look.
What, Kyle? The stock market's going to fail? Holy shit, Kyle. Heat up the printer. Heat up the printer. Make $3 trillion appear. And let's funnel it into the Ponzi scheme that is the stock market. Because the stock market is a direct reflection of American hearts everywhere. If the arrow's going down, that means hearts and souls of Americans everywhere is also going down. But look, it's working. It's going up. Americans are happy again. It's going up. It's skyrocketing. Wait. How the f- is it skyrocketing? We're all at home. How is this thing going? I thought it was all based off of revenue streams and quarterly earnings and nobody's working. I get Amazon. Everybody's at home ordering. This should be skyrocketing. Well, you, Jeff Bezos, and thank you, Jeff Bezos, all at the same time. Like, but how is it still going up, bro? I thought this is all based off of money coming in. Everybody's at home. Look, man, shut the up, okay? Just look at the arrow. God, can't you just shut your mouth and just be happy that the arrow's going up? No, I can't, bro. We need money. Look, here's $1,200. Hush money. Shut the up. Thank you. That'll last me a week. I appreciate that.
I just can't. I love that bit so much. It's just, that's, you know, one thing about the pandemic, what it did was it's like freeing everybody almost, you know. It's like, at least for me, these things I've been thinking for quite some time. And what the pandemic did is made the deception more visible. The idea of this is crazy stuff to say. It almost feels like it's pretty wild, but the fact of the matter is, like, people just started searching, like, why? What's going on? What? Asking more questions, and you see it all surface, and you can't really hide things when everybody's at home and now focused and watching the news 24/7, and there's so many different information flying around, and you see the despair, and you see, like, the almost an effort into try to split people apart from each other. And that's why I said in the special as well, like, I'm a Muhammad's living in Texas, get along with redneck Scots all day, you know? And how is it that the billionaires accumulated $1 trillion worth of wealth in the middle of the pandemic? Like, okay, like, give me a break. So it's just, I'm with the people. I'm always with the people. And I came from nothing, you know, like, we had something. My father would did very well for himself. The war happened, we lost it again, and to build it back up again. So I know what that feels like, and it resonates with me deeply, and I refuse to be distracted.
Now, most people don't know that you are a refugee to the United States. You came from Kuwait, you're a Palestinian American, and you credit, kind of who you are today a lot to where you grew up, and that's Houston. And that plays a kind of an important role throughout this stand-up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Houston is a city that raised me, embraced my whole family. I love it so much. And the intention of filming a television show in Houston was always number one. You know, 23 years of professional stand-up, but I've always wanted to and desired to showcase Houston because of how much love it's shown me, and it continues to show me. Also, it's kind of outrageous that the fourth largest city in America has never been portrayed on American television, which is so crazy. Instead of, like, I think RoboCop, there was like a glimpse of it in RoboCop, but it was never like, this is Houston. And it didn't really show how diverse Houston is, the most diverse city in America. The neighborhood I'm standing in right now, A-Leaf, where I grew up, I literally behind me is the apartment complex we moved to when I first came to the States, and where we're filming the TV show now. Which is so surreal to think about, like, makes me emotional. I can't believe we're doing this right now. And I'm doing an interview in the back of it. Anyway, it's pretty awesome.
You know, I don't know if most Americans have firsthand experience with a refugee. Give us, if it's possible, some perspective on how hard it is to restart from zero after coming here.
Man. And I think a lot of Americans do know how to start, you know, have started again from zero, but to be, particularly like Palestinian, to have a home that you can't really return to with full freedom is incredibly painful. And to just like drop everything and go and start a new life in a completely new world, essentially, it's definitely a massive struggle and requires you to dig deeper than ever. And what I would say is that Houston is a big savior for me because it's such a unique place that was easily to assimilate to. And I'm very thankful for that. I think things would be different if I ended up in Omaha, you know? So I'm very great. I have a lot of gratitude for that. It's just painful, and it requires, you know, if it's not dealt with properly, if you don't have faith, and what I mean by dealt with properly, like really digging deep into yourself and asking questions and healing yourself throughout the way, it can really disrupt your entire life in a significant way. And I'm a privileged refugee. It's very important to say that. We came on a plane. We had visas. We landed in Houston. Like, I'm an extremely privileged refugee. On paper, I am. But there's people living in tents, don't know where their parents are, lost their most of their family. So I am very low on the refugee spectrum. The people who have lost their entire, like, not only homes have been decimated, but their lineage is gone and they have to start over. So I can't even imagine what that's like. But so I consider myself very grateful that the circumstances are what they are for me, what they were for me. And look, I wouldn't be sitting in the back of a Mercedes, you know, filming a television series about my life if it wasn't for those experiences. So I would not change a single thing.
I want to ask, as an Arab American stand-up comic, how was your life, your work impacted in the era or the time right after 9/11?
Not at all. It was really easy being a Muhammad Mustafa Bedouin Ahmed Omar Najjar walking around here. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, when I was in, like, it was fine. Like, right before 9/11, I could talk about anything, speak about anything that was on my mind. And then after 9/11, it became a thing where I was like, oh, I have to do this now. Like, this gave it even more meaning than ever before. For instance, in this example, I had my room searched while I was on stage. I thought I was having a great time. I was like killing the audience. They were having a blast. And I sold out all my merchandise. I was like, oh my God, I made $800 in one night. Like, wow. And then I walk outside, there's cop cars everywhere and I'm surrounded by a couple of detectives. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? They started questioning me and asking me questions that nobody would really know unless you saw my paperwork or saw my passport or refugee travel document. And the audience was like, leave him alone. He was funny. Like, it was just really, really devastating and also hilarious at the same time. And, the way I left it is that they gave me a trash bag full of my belongings, you know, from my own hotel room. So they searched it illegally. They did everything illegally. And none of it was by the book. And when I got back to the hotel, the security guard literally said, your name is Muhammad. Like, literally she said that. So I was upset, but I also knew that it was really valuable for them to have an experience with me.
You talk about how there are kind of forces, whether it's the media or others, that are actively trying to divide Americans today, whether it's about the pandemic or about politics. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is, like, it's very lucrative to have people at odds with each other. If you watch one channel to the next, if you turn on CNN to Fox, it's significantly different. It's not like just a little bit. It is wildly different from the other. Why is that? How come one person is saying this? Well, how can that even be allowed? It's just mind-blowing to me. And I don't blame people in Oklahoma and Kansas and all these places for believing what they do. I don't blame them for one second. I think it's, like, really shameful to look down on those people and all these different parts of America that I performed in, and to say that, because what do they know? Like, this is what they're being fed on a regular basis. It's the opposite. Most of the time, these people are really simple, God-loving, fearing human beings that are being fed a particular thing. So that's all they know. You know, are some of them bad? Yeah, but so is everybody else. You know, like, this needs to stop. I stopped watching many news outlets because I read. I consume my news through reading now. I just can't. It's about, like, becoming celebrity culture within even news culture. Like, no, I just want to hear facts. And why is it spread that way? So I believe that is just because it's really lucrative and it makes a lot of money. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
Mo, I don't know if you've seen recently, there were these clips of Congressman Lauren Boebert and how she refers to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Let's take a look.
So the other night on the House floor was not my first Jihad Squad moment. So I was getting into an elevator with one of my staffers, and he and I were leaving the Capitol. We're going back to my office, and we get in the elevator, and I see a Capitol police officer running hurriedly to the elevator. I see fret all over his face, and he's reaching, and I'm like, "What? I can't, the door's shutting. Like, I can't open it. Like, what's happening?" I look to my left, and there she is, Ilhan Omar. Whoops. And I said, "Well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine."
So disgusting. It's funny because she's probably saying that with a gun on her hip at the same time, which is really hilarious. You know, I also don't think they even know what jihad even means. You know, it's just the ignorance is just through the roof, and it's absolutely despicable what she's insinuating in that particular speech. Also, the word jihad means to struggle. They've been struggling. It is the jihad squad. Honestly, it is the struggle squad. When she starts insinuating and throwing backpacks and terrorist stuff, man, it's just like such a crock of shit, and it's so despicable. And the fact that anybody could be in Congress with that kind of view or even say that without any kind of discipline for something like that is absolutely wild to me. Like, I cannot believe that. It's so incredibly racist. It insinuates something so horrific. And I know what those women stand for, and I know that's not it for sure.
Mo Amer, the special is on Netflix now. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Calling out all too frequent stereotyping. And that's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.